Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. A local reproductive health clinic in Gillette lost its county funding, and it could have some big impacts on the people it serves.
$25 wellness exams become $145 wellness exams, period.
We will bring you the latest on efforts by the state of Wyoming to purchase millions of acres of land in southern Wyoming. And you know what? It's not easy being a Wyoming artist.
In general, with anything, whether it's art or any profession or any type of thing you want to do, you just kind of have to do it.
Plus, Wyoming's congressional delegation is excited about efforts to get rid of regulations. It's all coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Access to affordable health care is always an issue, but especially at a time when people are losing their jobs or working less. In Gillette, a local reproductive health clinic recently lost its county funding that will likely impact the type of health care low-income people there will receive. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler explains.
Gillette Reproductive Health is located in a nondescript building surrounded by many other doctors' offices, pharmacies, and the hospital. Not many people in the community know it's there or what exactly they do. Julie Price Carroll is the clinic's executive director.
We had a physician say that we were the best kept secret in town. And we're like, wait, we don't want to be a secret. You know, anybody that needs us can come and use us.
But that best kept secret became a headline story after the Campbell County commissioners did not approve the clinic's $35,000 funding request after three of the five commissioners indicated they did not want to fund them. That's after questions surrounding abortion services and referrals rose to the surface. Gillette Reproductive Health mostly serves people who are uninsured, underinsured, or who have really high deductibles. And yes, men go there too.
So a lot of things we do are like wellness exams, pap smears, breast exams, clinical breast exams, STD testing and treatment, UTIs, sports physicals.
Carol says that they've even started providing more general services like diabetes care because they are seeing a growing need in the people they serve. The subject of abortions, referrals, and emergency contraception was initially brought up in a question and answer document that goes along with the funding application process. Deidre Reardon is the chair of the county commission.
A couple of the commissioners were concerned that Gillette Reproductive Health supported abortions, recommended abortions, or provided information as far as abortions go.
Those questions and concerns made their way to social media, causing heated community-wide discussions about what the clinic does and doesn't do. But Carol wants to be clear.
Gillette Reproductive Health has never performed any abortions, and no medical referrals have ever been given at Gillette Reproductive Health.
The nonprofit clinic has been the recipient of the Campbell County 1% tax funds off and on since 1999. But it's been continuously funded since 2010.
The county money was a direct patient money. What people would have to do is if they lived in Campbell County, they would have to give me different documents to prove that they were in need or whatever, and then they paid $25 for the well woman exam.
The clinic's board president, Wendy Gottner, says the cut may have a huge impact.
The moral conversation or the philosophical conversation derails us from providing services in our community. And in this case, the money goes nowhere else but to basic wellness exams. The bottom line is, without this funding, $25 wellness exams become $145 wellness exams, period. That's what happens.
Carol says if they can't replace that funding, the price of those exams could even go as high as $250. She says she is concerned for all of the patients who may not be able to afford this service, especially the women in this economic downturn who may see this as another thing they can go without.
When we are, as women, have children and our children are needing something, whether it's tennis shoes for school or a fee for an activity, We women sacrifice ourselves, so we're going to give that money that we have, whatever little bit we may have, we're going to give that to our children or to the events. We're not going to take that and spend it on ourselves through medical care.
Commission Chairman Deej Reardon, who supported funding the clinic, agrees the community will feel the impacts of the cuts to this service, and that includes other medical providers.
Something's going to give. If they don't have the funding, they won't be able to provide the service. Some of those things will end up at the hospital for emergencies and those type of things, and whether it's paid for or not is then up to the hospital, and it could be one of those things that's never collected by the hospital. So there will be some of that. Most of it will be things that just aren't taken care of.
That could likely drive up costs. Gillette Reproductive Health Board President Wendy Gottner says the effects have the potential to play out on a more personal level, too.
As we start to hear those stories from our neighbors and our friends, and maybe even experience it ourselves, I'm wondering if this conversation of blocking money to help folks get affordable health care might change a little bit. Because all of a sudden, it's the people we know who need this clinic, who need to have access to affordable health care.
Reardon says he's taken the board's overall decision as an opportunity to encourage the community to support the clinic. To kick it off, Reardon donated $500 to the clinic as a private citizen. Carol, the clinic's director, says while they haven't made any decisions about how they'll be handling the drop of funding, so far they've received around $11,000 in donations from the community to help replace the loss. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Catherine Wheeler in Gillette.
The Northern Arapaho tribe is once again suing one of its former attorneys in a continuation of a conflict that has divided the business council for over a year now. Wyoming Public Radio's Savannah Marr joins us now to explain. Hi, Savannah.
Hi, Bob.
Well, this is the second time in a year that the Northern Arapaho tribe filed a lawsuit against former legal counsel. Remind us what happened last time.
Right. So around this time last year, the Northern Arapaho tribe cut ties with a few of its top officials and advisors. The business council decided not to keep long-term Wind River Casino CEO Jim Conrad on. They voted to allow his contract to expire. And they also voted to fire Baldwin, Crocker, and Rudd. That's the Lander-based law firm that had represented them for decades, and the business council accused the firm of exploiting the tribe. They sued the firm, saying that Baldwin, Crocker, and Rudd was withholding tribal documents and tribal funds. I should say that that lawsuit hasn't yet reached a resolution almost a year later, but the firm denies any wrongdoing.
And if I remember correctly, those decisions about leadership turnover were not unanimous.
They were not. So the business council has been sort of split into factions, with the four newest members of the council, including Chairman Lee Spoonhunter, being more reform-minded and wanting to sort of clean house and bring on new advisors. But the two most senior members of the council, co-chairman Al Addison and Councilman Samuel Dresser, have not really been on board with that agenda. They voted against letting Jim Conrad's contract expire and against firing Baldwin, Crocker, and Rudd. When I spoke with them last summer, they rejected the idea that either had taken advantage of the tribe. They even likened the two firings to a coup and said that the Northern Arapaho tribe's new law firm, an Atlanta-based firm called Kilpatrick Townsend, had orchestrated it in order to gain control over the business council's decision-making.
So what does all of this have to do with the new lawsuit?
Well, here's what the majority segment of the business council alleges. They say that when Jim Conrad, the former casino CEO, was on his way out, he used tribal funds to pay Riverton-based attorney Joel Vincent, who formerly represented the casino, to sue the tribe's new law firm. And the council alleges that their own co-chairman, Al Addison, directed that payment to Vincent without the rest of the council's knowledge. And they see that as essentially stealing money from the tribe and using it to sue the tribe. They say that Vincent should have known that the payment wasn't authorized and that as an attorney, he had a duty not to accept it. Here's what Northern Arapaho Councilwoman Kim Harjo had to say about all of this during a web address to the tribe.
The need to bring these lawsuits has been difficult for us. Consistent with Arapaho tradition, as a council, we've always sought to resolve disputes internally and collaboratively. However, when others have not respected Arapaho tradition and in fact abused our trust and forgiven nature to enrich themselves at the expense of our tribe, we are fully prepared to take all necessary steps to protect the resources of our Arapaho people.
Now, I haven't yet been able to reach Mr. Vincent for an interview, but he does deny these allegations. He says that the payment he received was fully authorized and lawful.
All right, so obviously this is a complicated conflict. Can you boil it down for us?
It is, and if you've lost count, we're dealing with three different lawsuits here, and at the root of all of that conflict is a business council that's divided into factions that don't agree on a way forward. And as Councilwoman Harjo noted in that soundbite, that's not the way the business council is supposed to function. They strive to act unanimously. So regardless of who's in the right here, this is a huge problem for the business council and for the whole tribe. As for this newest lawsuit, I wanted to know whether there have been other cases where a tribal casino executive actually used the tribe's money essentially to sue the tribe. So I called up Catherine Rand. She's a professor at the University of North Dakota's School of Law, and she specializes in tribal gaming.
It sounds unusual to me. I'm not sure whether or not there have been similar situations that have arisen in Indian country, but it seems unusual. And if you think of the analogy to a state-run organization, and that the employees or the head of that state-run organization is unhappy and wants to sue the state, normally you wouldn't use state funds to sue the state without the state's own approval.
Professor Rand also said that power struggles between tribal governments and casino leadership do happen sometimes, but typically we don't hear much about it because it tends to get resolved internally. Usually an executive in Jim Conrad's position would sort of quietly move on rather than making such an aggressive move against the tribe on his way out.
So Savannah, when is this all going to end?
Well, the latest lawsuit will make its way through the county court, and seeing as the Baldwin, Crocker, and Rudd lawsuit is still not resolved after a year, it could be a while before a court makes a ruling on whether Joel Vincent broke the law by accepting that payment. In the meantime, business council elections are coming up in November. All six of the council members are up for re-election, so in a few months, the Northern Arapaho tribe could, in theory, be led by an entirely new group of people. It'll be interesting in particular to see if co-chairman Addison and Councilman Dresser, the two who make up that sort of minority faction, will stay on the council. They were some of the top vote-getters in 2018, and they're both long-serving council members, but it'll be interesting to see if they even run again after all of this turmoil.
And lastly, Savannah, what does all of this mean for the Northern Arapaho tribal members?
Well, as I mentioned, it means that the business council is not operating the way it was intended to, and that, of course, is not good news. But I will say that the business council has accomplished a lot recently. They've responded really aggressively to the COVID-19 pandemic. The tribally run clinic has done some of the most aggressive and widespread testing in the state. And the council has been supporting tribal members through the pandemic with food giveaways, by offering quarantine housing to those who need it, and even a rent freeze in tribal rental housing. The council just recently started a new propane business. They announced this month that they'll use some of their federal CARES Act aid to open a small meat processing plant, and that's something that's sorely needed throughout the state. All of this is to say that the distraction and the expense of these lawsuits hasn't prevented the council from getting things done. Still, it's no doubt in the interest of tribal members for the council to resolve these issues and move forward in a more united way.
Well, I'm in Public Radio's Savannah Marr. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Bob.
When we come back, we will hear voices from people of color from the region. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. Protests around the country are highlighting the deep history of police violence and systemic racism in the United States and the Mountain West. The Mountain West News Bureau's Nate Hedgie brings us the opinions of three Indigenous men about the protest and America's legacy of oppression.
My name is Robert Upham. I was raised on the Fort Belknap Indian Reservation, home of the Gros Ventre and the Assiniboine. I'm also the relative of the Dakota 38. The Dakota 38 were hung, the largest mass execution in United States history. They were hung by decision by Abraham Lincoln in 1862. They were hung a day after Christmas because of an uprising, because they wouldn't abide by their treaty rights and feed us our rations, which were accorded to us. We were starving to death. So the same guy that freed the slaves is the guy that hung us.
Kenneth Tuffy Helgeson. Wamnio Noajemajia Chen. Wasewak Bagichidaha Namakota. I'm an Assiniboine from Fort Belknap, Montana. There was an educator years ago who came and was doing some interviews with some old fellas, and he was asking them, you know, how it was on the reservation during the Great Depression. And the old fellow's answer was, we didn't even know what was going on. It's always hard here.
Some people think I'm co-opting a black movement. They don't know how much we're related. We're related because we're equally oppressed. And they keep saying on the news, the original sin is slavery. I'm sorry, but I'm an Indian man. I'm still alive. I'm the evidence of who once had title to this land. And the original sin is the theft of our land.
This is occupied territory. My American name is Alan Ray Matt, but my real name is Koomsta, C-O-O-M-S-T-A. You know, when they wanted us to go to war, we're the first ones to sign up. While we were saying pledge allegiance to the flag and going to war, they were busy taking our land and water here. Where my heart is on the ground today is because I returned over 50 years ago, and it hasn't changed. The cops are worse today. The cops are brutal. They're afraid of peace. You know, their world didn't work. It failed. So now, you know, they're in the minority now, and they fear that. I guess that's all I could say is fear, 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 because what we're listening to is the hearts of our people screaming out in any way they can for peace. That's the right thing. You know, that's all we can do, maybe. Us old guys, we pray.
As mentioned, the Mountain West News Bureau is taking a moment to listen to people of color across our region to share their perspectives on racial injustice and police violence. Ray Ellen Bichelle spoke to four black women from Colorado who are all scholars and activists. Their names are Rosemarie Allen, Janice Mackey, and Michaela Lee, and Carolyn Love.
When we moved into our home, my son was 4 years old. And all of my neighbors thought he was cute and well-mannered, and they loved him until he grew taller. By 12 years old, he was already 6 feet. And I remember the day my heart broke when he said, Mom, when I go for walks in our neighborhood, my neighbors don't speak to me anymore. They act like they're afraid of me. And he noticed that before they started calling the police on him.
With my kiddos, it was 2012, Trayvon Martin, and my youngest was two. Trying to talk to a two-year-old about what's on the screen, from the fires to the protests to the righteous rage, having to have those conversations with young ones, it's yet again in our face.
I am totally outraged by the black women that are perishing at the hands of police officers. It breaks my heart. Black women need a voice, and we need to be visible and present in the fight against oppression.
When I was young, if a black man was killed by the police, I would be sad, and then that was it. There's nothing I can do. And now I go straight to social media, and I start talking about it, and then I start sharing, and I start listening to what other people are saying, because now we have that option. There's a chance for people to get information and take action. And I feel like this generation is like eating it up.
When my son called me to tell me that he would be at the protest, I became very concerned. He is asthmatic. And I was afraid because the pandemic is real. And I expressed my concern for him. And he goes, Mom, I'm fighting for breath. What good does it do me to survive a pandemic and get killed at the hands of officers?
A lot of the people that are protesting out right now are youth, like people my age. And from what I've seen, especially in Denver, it's mostly people who are not of color, which like is very interesting to me. And I appreciate that because something that I was thinking about is I'm lucky to be in a generation where we have more compassionate youth who are willing to walk in other people's shoes and fight for other people.
Now, perhaps people are ready to engage in a conversation. But what I would say is, if that's going to happen, it better happen quickly. And I'm more on the end of public policy and of changing law. And until laws change, we can be in all the conversations we want. And all it is a feel-good conversation.
Simply naming race and racism isn't enough. Folks feel like they've done their work, if you will, by simply naming that. And it's like, eh, that's the easy part, actually.
This is not a sprint. It is a marathon, a very long one. And while we appreciate the allyship of participating in protest today, we need you more than ever, 6 months from now, 6 years from now, to create substantive changes that will definitely change America. George Floyd's daughter said, "My daddy changed the world." Let's make sure that's a reality.
When we come back, we'll hear an update on the proposed state land purchase and hear why our congressional delegation likes the president's effort to remove regulations. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Cooper McKim from our newsroom joins us now, and we're going to talk about this land deal. If you go back to the legislative session, there was a lot of discussion about whether or not Wyoming should purchase some large amounts of land along the I-80 corridor. Cooper's with us now, and maybe you should give us a little background on what they were trying to do.
So back in February, this was kind of the talk of the town, whether Wyoming should make a bid on this 1 million acres of land and 4 million acres of mineral rights across southern Wyoming. And there were a lot of people saying, hey, this could be a great rate of return, a great place to put our investment funds. And then there are other people saying, well, is this really the best use of our funds in a difficult budget situation? Well, so the whole time during the session, the Appropriations Committee went back and forth to set ground rules, figure out how to pay for it, basically conduct due diligence on the land up for sale, figure out the process that they would take to see how much it would cost, if it was worth it, debate over whether to use the rainy day funds. The chief investment officer for the state, Patrick Fleming, said there never was an estimate, but through many discussions, we heard that it was upwards of $1 billion. And there was this idea of finalizing the deal in a special session. Bills were combined. Eventually, the governor vetoed it, saying it was flawed, overly complicated, and burdensome. And basically, since then, the state has been working on how to make this bid happen.
So why aren't we talking about this again?
So it's kind of unclear what was going to happen next after the governor vetoed it. And that was in March. In May, we learned that the state was indeed still in the running along with 12 other bidders, according to an earnings call from Occidental Petroleum. And then more recently, Occidental set a July 1 deadline, and the governor's office confirmed that the state is indeed still in the running. In fact, They employed Barclays, a major investment bank, to do due diligence. In fact, had 23 bankers working on it, in addition to the treasurer's office working on it. The governor put together an advisory group of C-suite officials from oil and gas and mineral companies. So there's been a lot of work done on this, and it's all becoming clear what's been going on since then.
What are the considerations of actually making it happen?
So first off, the money side is different than I think a lot of people expect, because during the session we talked a lot about using our reserve account or maybe using bonds. But actually now, because the legislature didn't put together a bill that was accepted or signed by the governor, that it's up to the state to decide how this would be paid. And they could move around investment funds from the Permanent Mineral Trust Fund to make it worth it. And they're sort of identifying whether the rate of return on this investment would be better than other investments they have. And so they're going to be talking about this in the coming weeks, well, before July 1st, and hold a public meeting through the State Land and Investment Board, which is a group of five elected officials. And certainly we'll hear the pushback and arguments on both sides about whether a bid is actually worth it.
Yeah, and that's the follow-up question to that. I know a lot of people have been following what's been going on in the state. The state's maybe looking at budget cuts, and then maybe even more importantly, the oil markets have been very rough. So, you know, what are we talking about here, and why? I guess maybe you could explain why we're still doing this.
So there is a question of whether this sale might be a little bit more bargain bin pricing. There's a lot of disagreement over whether the value of it has gone down, given we never actually had a final confirmed cost of what it would be. But Occidental has been in a bad place since March. As many oil and gas companies have, oil prices have plummeted. They have consequently seen their share prices drop by half. Their budget has been reorganized down by half, took a $9 billion write-down on their assets, meaning it's just worth a lot less. So one economist says this company needs to make this sale, and it will almost certainly be less than the original asking price. And it's up to Barclays to determine what the actual price should be that makes it worth it for the state.
So what's next?
So next week, the State Lands and Investment Board will hold that public meeting and decide whether or not to pursue the bid. The deadline is July 1st, and the governor's office is expecting pushback. As you mentioned, a lot of other agencies have been told to cut their budgets. Meanwhile, the governor's office is looking at the significant purchase with investment funds. So there's going to be a lot to talk about next week, and we will know more soon.
Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim, thank you as always.
Thank you.
Wyoming is no stranger to the idea of diversification, with the coal industry in a structural decline. But it's not the only area coping with transition. In Appalachia, some communities that historically relied on coal have been reimagining themselves based on another natural resource, the great outdoors and tourism. But then came the coronavirus, threatening the emerging local tourism economies. From the Ohio Valley Resource, reporter Brittany Patterson visited some towns dealing with both coal's collapse and the pandemic's threat to newer businesses based on outdoor recreation.
Bill Curry has seen the Coal River change a lot over the past 16 years. The founder of a nonprofit dedicated to cleaning up the watershed, he says the river, which was once labeled one of the most at risk in the country, largely due to pollution from the industry, is now a growing economic engine for southern West Virginia.
Outdoor adventure is where the new world is as far as new tourism opportunities. And rivers are cheap. We own them. They're available. Once they're cleaned up, you know, they're an ideal platform to bring people from all of the United States to come.
And come they have, even during the coronavirus pandemic, which has flattened many other types of tourism. The Coal River Group has a fleet of 30 kayaks they rent to help support their work, and they've been busy, especially on the weekends.
We have 20 locations where you can get in the river. Every one of them was packed.
Kayaking and recreating outside, where the virus can disperse more easily, while not free of all risks, is certainly safer than many other activities we enjoyed pre-COVID.
You know, on a kayak, you got a 6-foot paddle. Well, that limits who can get very close to each other.
The $400 billion outdoor recreation industry is growing. And as demand for coal declines, some communities are hoping rugged mountains and plentiful rivers can be part of their next chapter. Jack Morgan with the National Association of Counties works with coal communities that want to diversify. He says many were in the early stages of making this transition when the pandemic hit, adding to the economic pain.
You know, reinventing local and regional economies is a hard enough challenge on its own, right? And this could be a significant bump in the road to many communities who, excitingly, are really starting to blossom.
That's especially true for the restaurants, hotels, and small businesses that tourists frequent after they come down from the trails. Fred Ramey is the city manager of Norton, Virginia, a small community of about 4,000 people that borders eastern Kentucky. The city has built campgrounds and hiking and mountain bike trails to lure new visitors. Right now, he says, the trails are bustling with people eager for a safe break from quarantine life. But the pandemic has struck a blow to the brick-lined downtown, where shops were forced to close for months and now must limit capacity.
We've been very concerned about the economic impact to those businesses and tried to do some things to support them through all of this.
The city offered small, interest-free loans to try to keep them afloat. But even with the current economic uncertainty, Ramey is optimistic. Many rural places haven't seen the high coronavirus cases that cities have. Telework is now the new norm.
If you can work from home, you can work from anywhere. And so that anywhere could be Norton, Virginia.
Back on the Coal River, Bill Curry agrees.
More and more people will move here so they don't have to live in a big city. And they can do this. They can make $100,000 a year sitting their desk, you know, in Rupert, West Virginia, as opposed to downtown Manhattan.
But he says, if you aren't ready to move just yet, you could always start by visiting and spending a day on the river. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Brittany Patterson in Tornado, West Virginia.
The Trump administration has aggressively moved to unwind an array of federal regulations since the coronavirus pandemic hit America. And that's in line with what Wyoming's federal lawmakers have wanted all along. But Matt Laszlo reports from Washington that one of them is contradicting President Trump and says more testing is the key to recovery.
As the economy went from breaking records to a recession in mere months, officials at all levels have scrambled to try and square this circle brought to us by coronavirus. For President Trump, that meant signing an executive order back in May, commanding federal agencies to rescind, modify, waive, or provide exemptions to any federal regulation they think or even claim will impede economic recovery. Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney is the number 3 GOP leader in the House, and she's fully on board.
We recognize we've got to do everything we can to help people get through this economic crisis and this challenge.
Since the pandemic took root on American soil, the administration has targeted mine safety regulations, Clean Air, Water, and Endangered Species Act ones, along with bank regulations and ones intended to protect student borrowers. There are also worker protections that have been wound back, along with wetland protections, and an effort is underway to loosen overtime pay requirements. While she's not endorsing every change, there are almost too many to count at this point. Cheney wants as many of these regulatory rollbacks made permanent as possible.
It's important, I think, that to the extent that we can maintain sort of this much lower level of government intervention in some areas, and some of the regulations that have been loosened up. Certainly, I think it would be beneficial if we're able to keep those from coming back again.
Senator John Barrasso chairs the Environment and Public Works Committee. He's on board with administration moves to unwind portions of the Clean Water Act. Barrasso's proud that it's in line with his legislation that forces states to issue permits within a year or risk losing local authority over local projects.
Part of what has passed the committee that I chair in the Senate, the Environment and Public Works Committee, actually helps us get projects done faster, better, cheaper, smarter. That's what people in Wyoming are looking for.
Barrasso's counterpart in the committee is soft-spoken Delaware Democratic Senator Tom Carper, who even issued a report entitled Pollution Pandemic. It highlights efforts by the GOP to relax fuel efficiency, ozone, mercury, and air and toxic standards. Carper says the anti-regulatory push is alarming.
We have a lot of folks who work in the EPA who are, frankly, beyond disappointed with the leadership that they've gotten on a bunch of these issues, but despondent. And they have been very ready to share with us from the inside all kinds of information that enables us to blow the whistle. And we'll keep blowing that whistle, and eventually, in a couple of months, we'll have an election, and then it'll be a new day.
Democrats are also upset about the regulations that aren't coming out, especially in the midst of a pandemic. OSHA, or the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, was established to protect workers. But OSHA's yet to release regulations that are federally enforceable. Democrat Bobby Scott of Virginia chairs the Education and Labor Committee in the House. He says this is deadly serious dereliction of duty from the White House.
They won't issue regulations when needed. We've been asking for an OSHA regulation to protect workers from airborne infectious diseases, and it hasn't been issued, so that in nursing homes and prisons and grocery stores and meatpacking plants, there have been outbreaks and no enforceable regulation to do something about it.
So how can the two parties broach this ideological divide and get the economy back on track? Wyoming Senior Senator Mike Enzi has a simple solution.
Testing. Yep, when people can be sure that they're okay and they're not working with people who aren't okay, that's one of the keys.
Unlike President Trump, who has called for slashing testing, Enzi says the economy is being held back because of the lack of testing, because that's even keeping schools closed, which then means parents can't go to work.
Testing is key to a lot of this, to give people confidence in being able to come back. And when they do, the economy will come back because people have a lot of pent-up spending.
The problem for Democrats and Republicans alike is that President Trump continues to berate and belittle the testing his own health experts are calling for. That has public health and safety advocates fearing he's going to triple down on his own call to unwind most every regulation he can find. For Wyoming Public Radio, Matt Laszlo in Washington.
When we come back, we'll have a feature on Lake Powell and also how tough it is to be an artist in Wyoming. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. This summer marks the 40th anniversary of Lake Powell being filled to capacity for the first time. It's one of the Colorado River's biggest reservoirs, but climate scientists studying the river find the lake's water source is quickly declining. From KUER in St. George, Utah, Lexi Peary reports on what a dwindling river means for Lake Powell and the millions of people who depend on it.
Here you'll find five national parks, over 40 state parks, and more shoreline than the U.S. Pacific Coast.
That shoreline includes nearly 2,000 acres around Lake Powell on the Utah-Arizona border, where the bright blue waters contrast with the red rocks that tower overhead. The rock formations and colors aren't unusual in the Southwest, but the size of this body of water is. Lake Powell is the second largest man-made lake in the United States. Lake Mead is the largest, and together they're used to manage the Colorado River. A 1922 agreement split the river's flows between the four upper basin states, including Utah, and three lower basin states. The water is used for farms, homes, and businesses. It's made development possible. And according to Brad Udall, a water and climate researcher at Colorado State University, the lake is crucial for honoring the commitments laid out in the Colorado River Compact.
Lake Powell is what the upper basin considers its bank account for meeting required deliveries to the three lower basin states. So it's essential to the management of the river.
Lake Powell first reached capacity in 1980. That was a wetter period of time for the region. Today, Udall says the lake is hovering just over half full, and a large part of that is due to climate change.
Since the year 2000, the flow of the river is roughly down 20%, and about half of that decline is due to these higher temperatures.
And as states continue to use the water, lower flows mean there is less to be stored in Lake Powell and Lake Mead. Even though extreme dry and wet years have fluctuated, the West is generally getting drier, says researcher John Fleck. He's the director of water resources at the University of New Mexico and says we're no longer in a temporary drought.
It appears to be this permanent phenomenon that's lowering the lake level, but you should not expect it to return to high lake levels over long periods of time. That's just not something we can expect to happen.
By 2050, researchers conservatively estimate the river will decline another 20% if precipitation patterns don't change. And Fleck says we'll see the evidence at Lake Powell.
40 years from now, I would expect that there will be a big bathtub ring.
This will have a major impact on a region that relies on the lake as a source for everything from drinking water and other residential and commercial uses to hydropower and recreation. Lake Powell only makes up 13% of the Glen Canyon National Recreation Area, but it helped attract more than 4 million visitors last year. And those tourists are spending a lot of money, to the tune of $420 million in gateway communities in 2019. Kane County Tourism Director Camille Taylor says she can't keep track of all the Lake Powell travelers, but anecdotally, tourism employees in Washington and Kane counties say 40% of their tourists make a stop at Lake Powell.
Lake Powell is a tremendous asset. It's water in the desert. It might as well be gold.
And beyond recreation, 40 million people from seven states rely on the Colorado River. While the river flow has declined, the demand for water has increased with regional growth. Upper and lower basin states are making drought contingency plans to keep Lake Powell and Lake Mead from reaching critically low levels. And climate scientist Brad Udall says they will also have to rethink their original water allocations from the 1920s.
It's hard to balance the equities of, you know, trying to respect these agreements that people have planned on versus changing circumstances that make the agreements totally inappropriate for right now. And I don't know what the answer is, but something's got to give.
In the next 40 years, it's unlikely Lake Powell will ever be full again. But the way people use the lake will change, and water will remain a crucial issue between the upper and lower basin states as climate change continues to alter the Colorado River.
That was Lexi Peary reporting. This story is part of an ongoing coverage of the Colorado River produced by KUER and distributed by KUNC in northern Colorado. Thank you. Last year was the launch of what's called the Wyoming Art Drop. That's a curated box of six unique pieces from local artists that can be shipped nationwide. Wyoming Public Radio's Megan Feary spoke to creator Lori Hunter about tourism, upcycling, and the unique pressures facing Wyoming artists. She says the first obstacle is location.
You're kind of secluded, and just getting people to find you in Wyoming can be challenging. Even to travel around the state and be in different towns at different art shows or fairs and things is challenging, especially in the winter. Just our geographic location.
So where did the idea for Wyoming Art Drop come from?
It came from a desire to get Wyoming artists out there more than as a venture to make money. Get the Wyoming artists and their work out to people who may not see it or know about them. Wyoming has so many great artists, and a lot of them are in more remote locations.
Wyoming seems to attract a lot of artists, but how feasible is it to make a living off of it here?
I think it's possible. I think there's a lot of great artists here who are out there in the world that are known. I just think it is a bigger challenge to get to that point. But I do think being here, we all can do a lot to support each other, not only inspire each other, but help each other get out there into the world and be a known artist from Wyoming and stay in Wyoming.
Considering the unique challenges of being an artist in Wyoming, what kind of environment do you think this creates? Is it competitive or more supportive?
The whole state's kind of the artist community, right? Because we're kind of a small state. Bigger cities, you have more competition, I suppose, and that creates more of a sort of enclosed mindset. I think most artists in the state really support each other. They know each other. They try to help out, whether it's with ideas or supplies or community spaces to work in. I think that's definitely a supportive community of artists.
Do you feel there's any pressure for local artists to cater to the kind of art tourists may want to buy instead of the kind of art that they may want to do?
I mean, I definitely think that there is tourism aspect to it. You know, even with Wyoming Art Drop, we do advertise it as a great way to buy your Wyoming souvenirs. Just purchase this one box. You get six pieces of unique original art. I do think that some artists play on that tourism and that, you know, a way to sort of pad their coffers so that they can do some of the things that they want to do that don't maybe cater to the tourists.
There's something about all of this that really feels like it taps into that do-it-yourself spirit that so many people associate with Wyoming, but I don't know. Am I reaching with that?
No, I definitely think that is the art community here. You know, you, in general, with anything, whether it's art or any profession or any type of thing you want to do, you just kind of have to do it because nobody else is going to, you know, so you just have to pick up the reins, do it yourself, and go for it. We can have such a unique lifestyle here, and we are kind of free to do things in a way that you may not be able to do in a bigger area or a different, more populated area, because we can sort of make these things up as we go and find support in our neighbors. Me being an artist in Wyoming kind of feels like freedom.
And you're an artist as well. Where do you tend to draw your inspiration from?
I call myself an artist, but I also call myself a maker. And I'm a big proponent of waste not, want not. Mainly I make journals from upcycled books. I take old books and make them into journals with new paper in them. I use the covers, bookmarks from the spines of the book. I make jewelry from the pages of the book. I make earrings and necklaces from the book pages. So a lot of my inspiration actually comes from throwing away less, reusing, recycling, upcycling, keeping stuff out of the landfill, reusing as much as we can.
So what does the future look like for Wyoming Art Drop?
We want to keep going. We had a lot of positive feedback. A lot of people loved it. And a lot of people both in town and out of town asked us about it, loved the idea. We had several orders that went out a lot in Wyoming, but then we also had a few that went clear to the East Coast and North and all around the United States. So it was really good.
Well, Lori Hunter, I wish you all the best, and thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you for calling.
That's Wyoming Public Radio's Megan Feary talking with Wyoming Art Drop creator Lori Hunter. Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. If you missed part of the program or want to hear or share an individual segment, you can find it on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. You can also find our stories on the station Facebook page or on Twitter. Anna Rader is our web editor. You can also find Open Spaces wherever you get your podcasts. Big congratulations to Wyoming Public Radio's Savannah Marr, who won a national award for Best Feature Story from the Public Media Journalists Association for her story heard on this show last fall on the transfer of bison to the Northern Arapaho Tribe on the Wind River Reservation. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.